Have you ever been to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier? In Washington, there is such a tomb, and it is a soldier, a very real American soldier. No one knows who exactly is buried in that tomb, but it is a grave to honor all of those who've fallen on a foreign field in a war, and because of circumstances, being blown up, et cetera, their bodies are not recovered, or their bodies beyond recognition. They do not know exactly who that person is. There's an inscription on that tomb, if you've ever been there. It's a very sobering thing to think about. But it says, and I quote, "Known but to God." It got me thinking about some things that only God knows. People are sometimes use the phrase, the Beach Boys, when I was a child. Remember the Beach Boys had a very popular song in the 60s called "God Only Knows." It was about a love between a boy and a girl and so forth, but that's not important. There are things that only God knows. And the Bible teaches us this and impresses upon us the knowledge of God and impresses upon us the position we have before God. If you're looking at Luke chapter 12, you're probably there, and let me turn to it. In Luke chapter 12, a parallel account to something that Ed read. I wanted him to read that passage for a phrase I'll use later in the sermon. But in Luke's account of this passage, and if you'll read with me in Luke 12, and let's start in verse 4. Luke 12 and verse 4, Jesus said, "And I say unto you, my friends, be not afraid of them that kill the body, and after that they have no more that they can do. But I will forewarn you whom you shall fear. Fear him which after he hath killed hath power to cast into hell. Yea, I say unto you, fear him." And then he makes the point of not only of God's power, but of God's knowledge. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 farthings? Now, if you're familiar with the language, you know that a farthing was the smallest coin of the realm of the Roman Empire. And 2 farthings would be less than 2 cents. I mean, it just is a small amount of money. So a sparrow's not worth very much. And he says, are not 5 sparrows sold for 2 farthings, and not one of them is forgotten before God? Now you think about that. He's impressing upon us the fact that God is so aware. God knows. We say God knows everything. But does that mean much to us? Are we impressed with that? Well, Jesus is impressing us with the fact that even the birds of the air. And I've explained it like this. I said, have you ever watched a migrating flock of birds? And I mean, when a flock of birds, especially of sparrows or something like that, almost literally blacken the sky when they are in mass flying overhead. I know down south at certain parts of the year, you can see them coming in, and they'll be so massive that they will literally stretch. You could get in a car and drive sometimes on a highway and see this. They will literally stretch for hours. There will be so many thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of birds in one flock. And so if you think about that, and you think about at any given point in time that God is aware of every single bird, the whole world over, at any point in time, there are literally billions of birds alive on the face of the earth, and God is aware of them all. Now, Jesus goes on in this passage, even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. No one has that knowledge. Not even you. I mean, we take for granted, some of us lose hair and all of that kind of thing, and we make jokes about it. But if you stop to think, how many individual hairs are on one human head? Some have tried to calculate it, but no one knows an exact number. God does. The Bible impresses us with facts like this and teaches us that God has that kind of knowledge. Now, he tells us, if you notice in the context, the context is about anxiety or worry. And so he's telling us of the knowledge God has to relieve us or to ease us of the burden of worry that we have. God would in turn then tell us in passages like Matthew 6 and verse 25 and again in verse 34. I emphasized that in one of the bulletin articles a couple of weeks ago. But God would tell us to be not anxious, or do not worry. in that particular passage. Be not anxious for the morrow. And several passages like that. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 6. In fact, I'd like for you to turn there and read that one with me. This is a verse about prayer. And when you look at this passage, again, God is saying, don't be anxious. Don't worry. And we're going to come back to the knowledge aspect and what exactly is being said. But let's read this together, verse 6. Be careful, are full of worry, are full of care for nothing. But in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. And I'd like for you to turn with me to Daniel 3. The young Israelites, Hebrew, we call them the three Hebrews sometimes, the three Hebrew children. They were actually young men here. They understand. And if you remember this incident, and I don't want to spend a lot of time, I'll get off into this passage if I'm not careful. But if you remember this incident in Daniel 3, Nebuchadnezzar wants them to worship an image of himself and commands them to do so. And there has been some trickery and so forth to get everything outlawed for a month's time, all homage being paid to any deity or king or whatever except to Nebuchadnezzar. Now, obviously, a faithful Hebrew is going to bow down to God. And so, when this music sounded and the Hebrews would not bow down to God, and it was reported, and Nebuchadnezzar confronts them. If you remember the story, and I'm sure you do. If you look at Daniel 3, and drop down with me in the middle of this at verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're Babylonian names, but that's what we know them by. They answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not, and notice this, we are not careful. We are not anxious. We don't worry to give you an answer in this matter. Why? It has to do with what God knows. They look at it and they approach it from the standpoint of what is going to happen is going to happen. God knows how he will deal with this situation. And that's true of so many things in our life. We don't. But God does. That's the standpoint or the point of reference from which Jesus is talking about in these passages in the Gospels. You can approach a situation rather than worrying, being anxious about it. You don't know how it's going to turn out. Well, God perhaps does. He can at least. He has the ability to know exactly what he will do anyway in the situation. And in this particular case, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego approach this situation from that standpoint. You'll notice what they say to the king in verse 17. They don't know, but here's what they say. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. If he wants to, what they're saying is, he certainly has the power to deliver us. Now, on the other hand, verse 18, if not, they don't know. God may choose to allow them to die in the furnace. There are reasons at times for someone to be martyred. So if not, be it known unto you, O king, we will not serve your gods, and we will not worship the golden image which you've set up. Now, how can they be so confident? How can they be so brave? Well, I don't think it's because they're superhuman. And I don't think it's because it's that they're better necessarily than you. In a similar situation, you might look at that and you might say, man, I don't know if I could do that. Well, you don't know. And none of us do until we face those kinds of situations. You never know exactly what you will do. You should meditate about such things beforehand. You should have a conviction beforehand. If ever faced with denying God or if ever faced with bowing down to a false God, I won't because I don't believe in it. I believe they went into it with that conviction, but the point of it all is this. They go into this situation with confidence. They trust God that if God chooses to deliver them, well, he has the power. Now, isn't that the same confidence you and I should have? Shouldn't I go into an anxious situation, one where I'm worried, and I'm one of these people, you may not be, but I'm one of these people that are given to worry. I've always had a problem with it, and I still do. It's one of my greater weaknesses. And when I go into such situations, my first inclination is to look at and begin to posit all the bad scenarios. This can happen, and this can happen, and this can happen, and begin to worry. And I'm one of these people that have to stop and check myself and say, now, that's not right, and what you should be doing, and go back to these same passages that I'm referencing. If you don't have that problem, be thankful for it. Because those of us that are given to worry, it's a tremendously burdensome thing. Here, they went into this situation with confidence. God knows. God knows the hairs of my head. God knows the birds that are out there. The passage Ed read, remember what it said in that one particular point at the passage where it said, and not one sparrow falls without the Father. There's not one bird that dies in this world. Birds die all the time, every day. I mean, they literally fall out of the sky. Cats kill them, etc., etc. But not one bird dies without the Father's knowledge. Not one bird dies if the Father doesn't individually know that animal. That's an incredible thing. And that's exactly what the Lord is saying. So if all of that is so, and it is, and if Jesus then reinforces that by saying, and you are of much more value to God than a bird. If that is so, then me in my particular situation that I'm facing with all of this worry that I may be conjuring up, God knows. And I really need to be. I need to have the conviction like these individuals did. God knows, King. God knows. And if God chooses, God can deliver me. And if He doesn't, I'm not bowing down. It's my conviction. I won't bow down to a false image or a false god. It's against God's law. I won't do that. But you understand, we believe in God, and we believe that God knows exactly what's happening at this moment in time. And God can take care of it. I mean, that's exactly what the Bible teaches us. Go with me to the passage that so many look to for comfort, and it is one of comfort. In Romans chapter 8, that's exactly what Romans 8 is talking about when it says, in Romans 8 and verse 28, we know as Christians that all things work together for good. Now, look at the context. We don't have a long time to look at it, but let's take a moment. When I look at the context here, the context is talking about me and my weaknesses. Look at verse 26. Likewise, the Spirit also helpeth our infirmities, or infirmity, depending on your translation, or your weakness. You have weaknesses. I have them. God knows that. Beyond that, there are all kinds of things that threaten me. Look later in the passage, if you will, at verse 35. Who shall separate us from the love of God? And then he poses several things. Would it be tribulation or trouble? Would it be distress, you know, a circumstance of life? Would it be persecution from other people? Would it be natural calamities like famine? Would it be nakedness, the things of life that I need that I sometimes find myself without? Or peril, you know, a particular destructive type thing that comes on us, like a fire or whatever it might be. Or sword, the threat of violence from other people. Notice as he goes on even to go beyond that in verse 38, and he says, I'm persuaded that neither death. Who doesn't fear death, at least to some degree? I mean, death is the great unknown. I don't know it. God does. But I know that it is something because I do not understand it and I do not know it that I fear it. Sometimes I think I'd welcome it, you know. I mean, when we're in, and I think all people are like that to a degree. When you're in great pain or sorrow or whatever, you look at that and you say, boy, I'd rather be dead. But then on the other hand, you think about it and you say, I don't know what it is to be dead. I don't know what it means to die. And we're afraid and we worry sometimes as human beings about it. But God understands. Listen to Paul here. Would it be death? Would it be life? I mean, just the hard circumstances of life that would separate you. Would it be angels? Now, a person might look at this and say, why would an angel separate us from God? Never forget that about twice as many good angels are bad angels out there who would separate you from God. And so, angels are all of these principalities, powers, things present, things to come. All of this about the height, the depth, or any other creation. He looks at life and he says, look at the universe and all of the things that would be in creation that would come against us at given points in time. And it can be overwhelming. It can scare you and be overwhelming, and you can tend to worry. And the point of all of this passage goes, go back to verse 28, The point of this passage, though, is not to be overwhelmed by either your own weakness or all of these forces that seem to be against you, but know that all things work together for good to them that love God. The knowledge that I can have, I may not understand how it's going to happen. I may not understand what God will do, but the knowledge I can have is that God at every moment in time knows everything. I don't. I tend to look at situations, and I'm sure we're all like this. Being human, we're limited. So all I can see is what's around me. All I can see is what I'm aware of. And when I look at any given situation and I look at myself in the situation, all I'm able to do is look at what I can see and what I can know. And maybe I look at it and I say, I can't beat this. I can't win over this. I can't control this situation. And if I get carried away in that, I can be overcome. But what I fail to do many times is to remember that there is far beyond my scope of knowledge, there's what God knows. I'll say one other point about it. Have you ever found a circumstance in life, and it doesn't matter what we're talking about, whether that would be there was a point in time when, I think a lot of people go through this, you're not with someone, you don't have anyone, you don't want to be alone the rest of your life, you're looking for an individual to spend your life with, and you begin to look around you, and your scope around you, you say, I don't see anybody for me. There's nobody for me. Only then to go through some circumstances. I mean, think of Montel and me. Look at our circumstances. If you had come to me a month before I went to this particular gospel meeting, and if you had said, what do you think your possibilities are of getting married? I would have said to you, well, at 35, and I haven't married anybody yet, they're less all the time. People even would ask something like that. Maybe not in those words, but something. And I would start making jokes about it, but deep down inside, I was already resigning myself to the fact that, yeah, I'm probably going to be alone. I'm probably one of those people that's just never going to marry. And yet God had already, I believe, God had already arranged for me to go preach this gospel meeting somewhere that I'd never been to before, and that there was someone there who was going to come to me and say to me, if I give you a name of someone, will you contact this person? Now, I was a person that was already gun-shy because of the blind dates and so forth. I didn't want that. You know, I didn't want to ever go on another blind date again. You know, some of you know exactly what that's like. But for whatever reason, I said, yeah, I will. And circumstances, without going through that Valentine's story, led to Montel being here tonight. God knows that. I don't. I didn't. But God does. God knew Montel down in Tampa, Florida, Michael White in North Alabama, is going to go to Tennessee, West Tennessee, and meet someone who's going to put him in contact, and these two people are going to get together. God knew that. God has knowledge we don't have. God only knows. I'll tell you something else that God knows. I'm not going to answer Wednesday night's discussion question, but I do want you to look with me at 2 Timothy chapter 2. And I want you to consider this, at least, as you're preparing for that discussion. God knows who are His. There's a very similar statement, for sake of time, I'm not going to turn to it, but I'll give you the reference. In Nahum chapter 1 and verse 7 in the Old Testament, the Lord knows those who are righteous. In 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19, nevertheless, the foundation of God stands sure, having this seal, this mark, the Lord knows them that are His. People are inclined to make statements that are really incredible. And you know, when you listen to people talk about history, for example, I believe a lot of people have, and I'll tell you, I believe it's a false misconception, or a false conception, a total misconception. People look back in history, and I think that people believe that, and I know I was taught this in school, for example, both schools, both Bible schools, that the Word of God began in Acts 2 to be preached The church was established on the day of Pentecost. There were Christians, etc., etc. And then the church fell away. And that everyone apostatized. And there were these gross, you know, all of the things you go back and read about, the abuses that went on in the denominations and so forth that we're aware of, the corrupt men who were leading them. You get into all of that kind of thing. Probably the most well-known things that atheists will choose to pick on are things like indulgences, or even worse than that, the Crusades and all of that. And they'll say, see, that's where religion was. But what's happened is that many Christians have bought into the idea that somehow the Word of God was established in the book of Acts and then just totally fell away. And then at some point later in time, be that the Reformation in the, you know, in the 1400s, 1500s as it began, or the Restoration, as some of us would look at it, in the 1700s, 1800s, and then the church comes back. Now, is that the truth? No, it's not the truth. Never has been, it never will be. And I'll tell you, sometimes we look at the past and we say there was a period when there just weren't any Christians, no churches, of really people practicing what they should have been practicing. And sometimes people look at the future and say, you know, if things continue like they are, the church is just going to die. And there's just not going to be a church in X number of years. Sometimes atheists make very bold statements, like Voltaire that we mentioned in the canonicity study. 100 years from now, there won't be a, you know, Christianity will be a thing of the past. People make very bold statements. But is it the truth? No, it's not. And when you listen to what God says, and I'd like for you to turn with me to Daniel chapter 2. The Lord knows those that are His. But listen to what it actually says. In Daniel 2, and the prophecy that is given about the church, about, you know, 600 years before the fact. But in Daniel 2, when the prophecy is given, read with me verse 44. In the days of these kings, now if you look at the context, obviously we're talking about the Roman kings. In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom. He speaks of the church, His kingdom. Jesus speaks of the kingdom in Matthew 16. In the same paragraph, He speaks of, I will build my church, and I will give you, the apostles, the keys of the kingdom. Well, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom. Now listen to the language. Which shall never be destroyed. Now, is that the truth or not? Was the church, the kingdom, established on the day of Pentecost, but yet destroyed? 300 years later, 400 years later, 500 years later, 600 years later. Doesn't matter what time you want to put on it. Is that what happened? Or in fact, just because we do not know where faithful Christians were. In other words, someone will come along and say, well, you just don't have any historical reference of there being a church with people simply and faithfully worshiping like God had them, you know, told them to be worshiping according to the New Testament. You just don't have that. How do you know? How do you know that that wasn't the case? How do you know that there were not people? How do you know, for example, in the caves of the Black Forest in ancient Germany, there weren't Christians meeting and worshiping God as they should be worshiping in the year 723? How do you know that? I've asked people before who want to contend that because we have no historical reference, then that means there was no church. And I've said to them, how do you know? Isn't that really arrogant to say because we have not yet in modern times found a historical reference where we can be 100% sure? Now, I can show you some that are, you know, pretty indicative. But again, 100% sure, where somebody said, you know, we are the Lord's church in this place in the Black Park. Because we don't have that, that means the church didn't exist. How do you know that? I'll tell you what you can know. You can know two things absolutely for sure. You can know, number one, that God knows everything. That God can look down on this earth at any second of time and say, I know where my church is there, and there, and there, and there, and in this room I know that person is faithful, and that one's not, and that one's struggling at every point in time. And I know that you can also look at Daniel 2, and when God says that He will set up a kingdom, quote unquote, which shall never be destroyed, that's the truth. So I don't have to have a historical reference that tells me in the year 723 or 819 or 998 or 1162 or whatever year you want to pull out of time and say, where was the church in that year? I don't know. But God does. We might find a reference at some point in time that tells us in 723 there was a church. It still won't mean that we have a reference for 1162, will it? But God knows. God knows at every point in time. And I'll tell you something else God knows. As far as the future, look with me at 1 Thessalonians 4. Now, we often read this at funerals and so forth. I've read it at many myself. But there's something that's indicated here for certain. When we start talking about, you know, the world is becoming more and more immoral all the time. People believe in the Bible less and less all the time. And when you start talking about that kind of thing, people get fearful. Will there be a church? Will there be faithful Christians? Absolutely. Somebodies on the face of the earth will believe in God and be faithful whenever He comes back. And you can know that from passages like this. Listen to 1 Thessalonians 4. Not read to give hope in this case tonight to those who have lost a loved one, but to give all of us hope that the church will never be destroyed. I would not have you to be ignorant, verse 13, Paul says. I would not have you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning them which are asleep, those who have died, that you sorrow not. Now notice verse 14. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so them which sleep, those who are dead in Jesus, will God bring with them. And this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that, notice, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord shall not go before those who are dead. What does that say? That is telling you just like, and I won't turn to the passage, but you could, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, you can see also the idea of people who will be very much alive when Jesus returns. Now, what does that say? Here is referencing people who are alive and remain when Jesus returns, and they are going to be saved. That means that the church is never going to be destroyed. It will not reach a time on this earth, never has and never will reach a time when there are no Christians and there is no faithful church on this earth. When Jesus returns, whenever that is, be that tomorrow or 10,000 years from now, no one knows, but God only knows. But there will be faithful Christians. We don't know. I think sometimes we think we know many things, but we don't. Only God knows. And while I'm talking about that, let me mention one other thing. When my computer died the other day, and the tech came in. And I've known this guy, you know, unfortunately, given my luck, you know, I've had my share of computer problems. If it can go wrong, it goes wrong, right? So this guy and I have gotten to know each other pretty well. You know, I call him up, he knows my voice. I mean, it's bad, you know, when your computer tech knows you. And I said to him, I said, you remember where I live? Oh, yeah. You know, when he got to my house, I said, you remember where it is? Oh, yeah. Up the stairs he went because that's how bad it is. But I said all of that to say this. We get into conversations about different things. And so he brought up, you know, and he just launches in and brings up about 2012. And, you know, and he's picked up, as so many people out there have and are talking about it. You know, 2012 is getting closer all the time. Now, those of you that are not aware of that, remember 2012 and what is it, the Mayan calendar? Some of you that know that better than me. But it's supposed to be the, you know, the winter solstice, I think it is, of 2012 or whatever, and the world is supposed to end. Now, we talked about some of that in the study of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Nobody knows when the world's going to end, and we don't know how. I mean, we have lived through yet another time when it seems like the masses of the world are concerned with the end of time. I don't think that's surprising. Even in our day and time when people are not necessarily overly religious, right? I mean, we're not living in one of those times where we're in a Puritan age or anything. And yet people are still, you know, when's the world going to end? How's it going to end? It doesn't matter if you're religious or you're secular. I mean, secular individuals are talking about the world ending from the standpoint of an asteroid, or the world ending from global warming, or whatever it might be, you know, and all the effects of that. And religious people are, you know, They're looking at it from the standpoint of maybe premillennialism or whatever it might be. And so they're all concerned about it from that standpoint. And then there's yet the superstitious people and all of those, you know, that want to look at things very mystical like the Mayan calendar or whatever it might be. And before that it was the Sumerian calendar and on and on and on it goes. People are enamored with the end of time, the end of the world. That's just something that's on the minds of individuals. We ought to use that, you know. Because we should be concerned with the end of time. But concerned about it from the standpoint of what God says. And what does God say? Well, it's very simple. In Mark 13 and verse 32, Jesus makes it very clear that no one knows the end of time. You look at that, Mark 13 and verse 32, Jesus says, the Son of God Himself does not know. You look at Matthew chapter 24 and verse 36, Jesus makes it clear, the angels do not know. I do not know. The Holy Spirit does not know. Only the Father, Matthew 24, 36. There's only one individual who knows when the end of time is coming, and that's God the Father. He's absolutely the only one, and the Bible makes that clear. Now, beyond that, God makes it clear also that there is not going to be, someone is not going to be able to figure out by circumstances in this world when the end of time is coming. It will not be. I don't know what is going to happen winter solstice of 2012. I have no clue what's going to happen. I don't know if things, you know, I realize all of the astronomical, you know, I get into that a little deeper maybe sometimes than I ought to. And I understand all that about the, you know, the lining up of the planets and all of that kind of thing. And I understand, at least to some degree, I understand this idea about reverse polarity and all of that kind of thing. I get into that kind of thing. It's fascinating to me. I don't know what's going to happen on that day. I don't know if there is going to literally be a reverse of the pole. I doubt it, you know, but there might be. And there might be storms like we've never seen. That could happen. I mean, just like there can be a disease that comes along like we've never seen, a pandemic like we've never seen, it can happen. But one thing that I know for sure, it's not going to be the end of the world. And I don't know if global warming, if there is such a thing, I don't believe it, personally. I'll just give you my opinion about it. I think that the world goes in cycles. There's evidence for that. But regardless, if there is such a thing, and if the water is going to rise and it's going to drastically change the economics of the world, I believe that can happen. Do I think, literally, that at some point in time circumstances could put New York City underwater? I surely do. But the world is not going to end if it happens. Life will be different. No question. But the world is not going to end. The Bible is very clear to us how the world is going to end. Go back to 1 Thessalonians 4. Look at 1 Thessalonians 4 and read verse 16 very carefully. The Lord Himself is going to descend from heaven when the world ends. And He's going to come with the voice of the archangel. A shout from God. And everyone is going to hear. And there's going to be a trumpet that sounds. It's going to blow. And sometimes people might look at that and say, who can believe that? Who can believe that a trump can blow, or a trumpet can blow, or an angel can shout and everyone in the world can hear it? Who can believe that? I can. And I'll tell you why I can. Because I knew a great-grandmother who came to Alabama in a covered wagon when she was 12 years old. And had you sat down and talked to her and said, do you believe, and her name was Hattie, do you believe, Hattie, that in your lifetime you're going to witness people fly in the air in a machine? Why would she believe that? But by the time she was a young woman, just newly married, people were flying in the air. If they had said to her, Hattie, do you believe that when you're in your 60s, that you're going to see people not only fly in the air, but fly to the moon? And she would have said, nobody's going to the moon. But she did. If they had said to her, Hattie, do you believe that by the time you die, you are going to see a space shuttle and begin to describe this massive machine? I've stood beneath one, literally. It is massive. And begin to describe the speed at which this thing will fly through the air. If they had said to her, Patty, do you believe right now the telephone has just been invented? You're a little girl and the telephone's just been invented. And it's a marvelous thing. You can actually call somebody miles away and talk to them. But do you believe that by the time you die, instantly, people are going to be able to push a button and not only see but hear people anywhere on the face of the earth? Why would she believe that? Now you say to me, it's impossible. It's a fairy tale to believe in a shout that everyone in the world can hear. Why? We've lived in a time that, if anything, the fairy tales of the past have come true one by one. Man going to the moon. Man flying through the air at the speed of thousands of miles. I mean, it's incredible what we've lived through. Why is anything unbelievable? Now, that's just separate and apart from the power of God. And if there is a God, and He has the power to make this world and make us with the ability, composite at least, with the ability to create such things, why does that God not have the power to have an angel shout and everybody hear? Why is that so far-fetched? It ain't far-fetched to me. And the world is going to end someday, and Jesus is going to come. And if you're looking at 1 Thessalonians 5, and you see this passage, He's going to come like a thief in the night. No one is going to be able to figure it out. No one is going to sit down and plot when it's coming. No one is going to take a calendar 2 or 3 or 4 or 5,000 years ago and plot and say, that's the end right there. It won't happen. There are no signs. There are no signals. There are no circumstances leading up to it. You're not going to be able to. And I know people do this all the time. If people are not looking at such a calendar, they're looking around the world and they're saying, well, you look how many people are becoming unfaithful to God. That surely means the end of time. Why? Why does that mean the end of time? Is there not an equal scenario that shows us that the world goes through a very ungodly period of time only to come back and be extremely godly again? Study history. This happened plenty of times. Or someone says, man, look at all the diseases and the hunger and so forth in the world. The world cannot go on. People are just going to die. 80% of the population is going to die. All right, maybe it will. Does that mean the world can't continue with 20% only to repopulate the earth again? Study history. Isn't that exactly what happened during the times of the Black Plague and so forth and so on? We have no clue when the world is going to end. We cannot be confident of tonight at 9 o'clock. We don't have any idea. And no more so than we can be confident the world can't go on for 10 or 20 or 100 or 1,000 more years. We just don't know. God only knows. What you and I need to do is to be mindful of what the Bible really says. And I'll give you a passage, Deuteronomy 29 and verse 29. It's easy to remember because it's 29:29. The secret things, and there are plenty of them, the secret things belong to God, only to God. And what you and I need to be mindful of is that we are not God. No matter how high we become, how intelligent we become, we are not God. God only knows. And trust that. Rely upon that. And have confidence in that. Just be faithful to God, just like those three Hebrews. We don't know what's going to happen, but you know one thing for sure. We ain't bowing down to no statue, because there is a God, and we serve Him.